I'm going to ask those of Ken and let him kind of walk through a few of those. We'll have 2, 3, maybe 4 of those. And then we're going to open it up to questions on the floor. And after that time, if you have a question, just raise your hand up. Someone will come by with a microphone and give you an opportunity to ask this of Ken. He's had a pretty long day today. And so we're going to try to limit, this to about 30 minutes tonight. And then we'll pick up in the morning. Session in the morning starts at 10. If you could be here about 10 minutes before that, that'd be fantastic. Lunch will be after that, and then there'll be another session after that one. Both would have Q&A. So you'll have, if you think tonight when you go home, have some questions that come to mind, you'll have a chance to ask those in tomorrow's session. Ken, the first question that we want to ask, just kind of piggybacking off of the last thing that you said in the lecture just a moment ago, is if what we see in Colossians 1:20, Matthew 28, the ideas of reconciling all things and Christ having authority over all things, under the authority of Christ in the gospel, are there things in the world that cannot be made beautiful through the work of redemption?
If you read how theologians have talked about this, some would say that. Let's distinguish first of all between created things and our manufacturing of things, and I think that this is something that this is a confusion that sometimes shows up, that people say, well, Christ is Lord of all things. So all things are potentially redeemable, when it comes to aspects of human culture or human making, let me start with institutions, specific institutions. Then we'll talk about artifacts or styles or forms. Often Christians say we want to have an influence in the culture, so we want to influence every aspect of culture, so let's get involved in let's find the dominant institutions, the institutions that have a great influence, and let's get Christians involved in that setting so we can, and they often use the language of a kind of redemptive approach to culture for this. Well, I'd say that I'd rather talk about spheres of experience rather than given institutions, because it may be that the institutions that we have erected to accomplish certain tasks are already deformed and not adequately constructed to do the task at hand. And a good example would be if you were in the Soviet Union in the 1970s and a Christian, would you try to reform the Communist Party? Or would you want to overthrow the Communist Party? If you were living in Las Vegas right now, given how prominent casino gambling is, well, maybe we ought to have a Christian casino. Maybe that would be something to do. Or a couple times in the last couple of days, somehow mixed martial arts has come up in conversation. We need Christians involved in the... Actually, there are Christians involved in mixed martial arts. And you could kind of start making the list, and you realize that there's a difference between, say, with the case of the Communist Party, there's a difference between our political life or the political sphere of life and specific political institutions. So in the political sphere, certainly Christians should be active and concerned about how things are governed within the political sphere. But that doesn't mean that at any given time in any given place, the institutions that are currently dominant are the institutions that we have to try to fix. Having come out of broadcasting, CNN is a pretty big voice in broadcasting right now. MTV is a big voice in broadcasting. But I'm not sure I'd want to try to reform either CNN or MTV. As a journalist, I think the idea that people need to become addicted to novelty and you know, really want to see some news story all the time. There's a wonderful book called Why the News Makes Us Dumb by John Somerville. He was a history professor, I think. But You know, I'm not sure that the CNN's approach to journalism is really the best approach. I don't think it serves the ends that would be appropriate in the world of journalism, or would be best in the world of journalism. And then I won't talk too much about MTV. But I think that institutions have a kind of momentum where they're going in one direction, and while they may be serving a sphere of life that ought to be served in a good way, and in a way that honors Christ's lordship, it may be that the institution is so malformed that the best way to serve in that sphere is not to try to reform that institution. Well, and I see this now with education. A lot of Christians have decided that our system of public education, it's not just that we have bad people running it, but there might be something about the whole system that is misguided, that's misstructured. So we may not be able to reform the system. So let's replace with a better option. Let's come up with a better model in education that would serve the task of education. Now, I think you could say the same thing with specific schools of art, for instance. When I was in college, one course I took was in contemporary English-speaking drama theater. And one of the movements we studied was wasn't just English, because there were French and German, the theater of cruelty, which came out of existentialism. Now, that was a very trendy and significant movement in drama, but I'm not sure it was redeemable, because I think its fundamental premises about what it was aiming to do and why were so corrupted. Now, that doesn't mean that theater itself would necessarily be improper. Although I can imagine circumstances where somebody might come to that kind of conclusion. But so I think the task would be to say, what end, what human good is being served by this institution or by this school or by this particular set of artifacts? And then ask whether the approach that's already ingrained could actually be used. Now, with regard particular to beauty, in the last 80 years or more, in the visual arts, there have been movements in the visual arts which have, they very deliberately rejected the very idea of beauty as a possible aim. So it seems to me it would be impossible in that kind of setting to say, well, let's work for beauty within a system that denies the possibility of beauty and repudiates it. I mean, again, you'd have to replace it with a system. And some of the techniques of painting or presentation that came out of that were techniques which were an attempt to reflect that. In music, for instance, in the 20th century, the most famous case would be serialism or 12-tone music, which among its practitioners, beauty was not something that was on the list for them. That they had already decided that beauty is not something. They didn't want to make music that was beautiful, and I think they did a very good job at achieving that. they were quite successful. we can commend them for their integrity. Every now and then they might slip a little bit, but they came to their senses. So I don't think you can make beautiful 12-tone music. I think it already has some deficiencies. It's denying itself access to certain things. Now, let's get a little less arcane, maybe. One of the aspects that many, many people, at least as far back, I think you can probably find it in Augustine, have talked about, one of the characteristics of beauty is proportion, that things are properly proportioned. In a lot of art forms, and I'm thinking particularly in film and in music, there are techniques that are used that are disproportionate, are intended principally to create a sensual or sensory experience, an experience of the senses, but an experience of the senses that doesn't involve emotions and reason and all of the other things. Tomorrow I'll talk more about how when we experience beauty, we experience it through the senses, but we experience it intelligently through the senses. We perceive intelligently the various aspects of proportion and unity and composition, the other attributes that. But if a style is so insistent on being disproportionate from the beginning, and one of the things I'm thinking about in film is the tendency to in some contemporary film styles for incredibly fast cutting. So it produces what one critic called a sub-visual experience. I mean, your optic nerve is experiencing it, but it happens so quickly that I had to glance at the ophthalmologist, and I may be wrong in describing it that way. Your body is perceiving something, but it's perceiving at such a pace that you can't possibly attend to it. Now, I think that, I think there's a sense in which a certain lack of proportion in the use of time, at that point, it disqualifies itself from beauty. So there would be a case where you have a style that you just can't work with if beauty is your aim. And again, it wasn't ever chosen as a style to be beautiful. It was chosen as a way to be gripping or not attractive, gripping or kind of almost addictive, that we want people to have a sensation. Aristotle, in his Poetics, talks about the danger of sensationalism, how sensation can crowd out lots of other things, in drama in particular. So I'd say, I think we just have to look at the elements in any given either institution or artifact or style and ask, is there already some impediment to beauty or some obstacle to beauty that can't be overcome unless we eliminate that obstacle? So that's a long-winded answer. But did you have another one, or are we moving to some?
I've got a few pre-written by some folks. So, one other question given by someone in our audience. If we are going to limit beauty to terms of things we can perceive, interact with our senses, when we view the work of artists, how do we determine beauty objectively through that?
I'll talk about that to some extent. I mean, I can't. One of the things that people who write about beauty point out, and I will talk about this in the first lecture tomorrow morning. A beautiful work, either a beautiful work of art or a beautiful something beautiful encountered in nature, we can isolate the attributes that contribute to the perception of beauty. But you can't insist that that's a universal list of attributes that every beautiful thing will portray. So the appraisal of beauty, I have a friend who's an artist, and he says aesthetic judgments follow a kind of fuzzy logic. We like the clarity of a syllogism that says, if A, then B, or if A and B, then C. He says, art doesn't work that way. Art works that if A and maybe B and sometimes C, never D or E, and occasionally F, then probably X, probably never Y, almost certainly never Z. So it works with that kind of fuzziness. And so if you try to extract, if you try to analyze, that is, if you try to reduce it to its component parts, and then say, okay, let's look for those parts somewhere else. Well, you may or may not find them. You may or may not find them. One of the things that also is written, again, for hundreds and hundreds of years about beauty is the perception that a work has wholeness. that it has, it gives the impression of being complete and not having something missing in it. And that suggests to me that it becomes, I mean, again, you can identify the elements that contribute to its beauty, but you can't abstract those elements out as components like you can, okay, this pen has components that I can separate out and I can possibly replace one of the components with something else. One of the things about beauty, I'll quote David Bentley Hart again tomorrow, where he says it's impossible to define. And one of the things that you find in writing about beauty is that there are descriptions of beauty's attributes, but there aren't strictly definitions, and there certainly aren't checklists. So I'll try to get a little more into that. And I really think that, particularly with any form of artistic expression, it really helps more to do a lot of looking. And I think what you find is if you do a lot of looking and talk to other people who do a lot of looking and read the work of other people who do a lot of looking, it turns out that some kind of consensus, some kind of rough consensus emerges that is capable of evaluating and rating things. But having said all that, I think there's a possibility of finding beauty in lots and lots of things. So I don't think beauty is a kind of I don't think there's necessarily a threshold below which there's no beauty, and you know, boy, this just barely got beautiful. when theologians talk about beauty, somebody like Thomas Aquinas, he talks about how there's a sense in which truth, goodness, and beauty are present in everything in creation, in some way, and. Because of the fact that if truth, goodness, and beauty are attributes of God, then everything that God has made reflects the Maker in some way. So the trick is, what is the some way, and how do we talk about that? So hope that's not too evasive.
I think you're probably going to answer this tomorrow. But would you say that postmodernism, and I know that's incredibly hard to define, in some way embraces the senses again? Not that they find meaning behind it, but do you think that they embrace the senses again?
Yeah, I think postmodernism, whatever that is, postmodern thought certainly challenges the kind of arid supremacy of reason that marked modernity. And I think it does. I think also postmodernism for good and ill, reintroduces the idea of delight in aesthetic matters and play, which are tied to beauty, really. So I think that Enlightenment thought focused everything on truth, and truth defined in a really narrow way. And I think that postmodern thought does open itself up again to other possibilities, and I think it does open itself up more to, outside of aesthetics, also, it does. It is more open to affirming the senses. Now, again, it doesn't. I mean, postmodernism is in many ways hypermodernism. I think And a number of critics have written about this, that there are aspects of modernity that get intensified and universalized and, in a sense, democratized by what we call postmodern. So, for instance, if modernity is really emphasizes a kind of subjectivity where the individual self becomes a sovereign arbiter of things, that becomes even more intensified in postmodern time. At least for modern thinkers, there was still some notion of the possibility of some transcendent unifying principle that everyone could arrive at. But that's totally absent in postmodernity. So, I mean, again, I think a lot of Christians responded to postmodern thought initially in an entirely negative way. And now in the last 5 or 10 years, a lot of have responded in an entirely uncritically positive way. And I think it's better, I think what Christians ought to do is say, where did modernity go wrong? And how has postmodernity challenged some of those errors? And then how has postmodernity reinforced others of the errors? And then, I think the big mistake Christians make is assuming, well, because our culture is postmodern, we're going to have to be postmodern in order to be relevant, which is, you know, because our neighbors are lascivious, we have to be lascivious in order to. I mean, I think that it's kind of a silly assumption. But I do think that it shouldn't be dismissed as all bad by any means. And I think that you maybe, I haven't thought that much about the body, but I think there is more of an openness to a kind of diversity and a specificity in postmodern aesthetics. So, and I don't know how much more I'll talk about tomorrow. I might.
Ken, Romans 8, it says the creation groans up to the present, experiencing birth pangs. Even believers who have the first fruits of the Spirit are groaning, awaiting adoption,
right,
as sons. Do you see the church bringing in this ultimate beauty, or do you see this ultimately occurring at the new heavens and new earth?
Oh, I definitely think it's the ultimate is definitely eschatological. And yeah, but I think that that the church is in a position of anticipating, and I really do think that some theologies underestimate when Paul says, you know, old things have passed away, behold, the new has come. The new has come with the resurrection. You know, the theology of the resurrection in Paul, it's a decisive event. And so something has changed. Something has changed. But the fulfillment clearly is, and we're not going to be able to affect the fulfillment, but we should anticipate, we should represent to the best of our ability what that fulfillment might be like to the best of our ability to understand it. We should, just as in the Lord's Supper, we anticipate the marriage supper of the Lamb. You know, I think we ought to, for instance, anticipate, historically Christian ideas of justice were an anticipation of eschatological justice. They weren't involved in judgment, because we knew it wasn't our task to judge. That's pretty clear from Scripture, to execute final judgment. But nonetheless, we are systems of justice are systems that do anticipate final judgment in some way. And I think there has been that idea of anticipation. How do we express that anticipation? Some Christians have thought we could fulfill it. And we can fix it now. I mean, I think that's a mistake of the social gospel movement, which thought, yeah, if we can engineer this fulfillment in some way. And so I think that's not true. But I think we shouldn't be entirely pessimistic about the possibility that we can anticipate and represent it better. Just as we can't be perfectly loving, but we still try to be as loving as we can be, anticipating what that full love might be like. So,
anybody else? I'll take the moderator's privilege and ask the last Lynn, I don't want to be accused of anything here by holding the mic. I'll take the moderator's privilege and ask the last question, if that's all right. Can beauty in and of itself convey meaning that cannot be discerned by Descartes closing his eyes and retreating into the recesses of his mind? And if so, what sort of articulable truths can be attained from that?
Well, you were fine until the semicolon. And I say that with a lawyerly respect. It's interesting. My daughter was reading a book that we did an audio version of a book a few years ago, right after she'd graduated from William and Mary with her degree in medieval and Renaissance studies. And I had her, actually, she didn't have a job at the time, and I taught her audio editing. And so she could edit this thing for her. I'd already recorded it, and she was doing the editing. And she had a copy of the book. She says, "This book's driving me nuts." I said, "Why?" She said, "They use the word truth and reality interchangeably. This isn't..." And she, you know, she pointed out all these passages. She was absolutely right. They would talk about truth, and what they meant was reality. I think that beauty conveys aspects of reality that sheer reason can't. And I should say that Descartes isn't just by avoiding the physical world, by avoiding the realm of the senses, Descartes had to, in a sense, detach reasoning from language itself, because language is based largely on metaphoric expressions. If we stop and analyze our language, it's hard to say a sentence that doesn't have a reference to some spatial, temporal, physical reality at some point or another, even if it's in the etymology of the word. But so it's almost impossible to use language without some kind of reference to the physical world. And it's obviously impossible to use language that hasn't been anywhere. I mean, to use a language, you're using a toolbox that has been part of a history. And that history has conditioned that language through the actual experience of people in space and time. And that's why I think Descartes gets to the point where that perfect knowledge has to be mathematics. It has to be mathematical. It can't actually be any kind of expression. The truth is an equation, finally, and not something verbal. He has to eventually, I think he doesn't quite get there, but people got there after him, to eschew all verbal expressions because they're all contaminated with the same kind of thing his sense perception are. So I'm not... I'm not sure that much about reality. I mean, there's certain aspects of mathematical reality that might be conveyed, but I'm not sure. The fact that God's goodness is described in Scripture in metaphoric terms, he's a shepherd, he's a father, you know, all kinds of metaphors that are used. The idea that we could do a better job describing God if we didn't have those metaphors, I think is false. I think that's a mistaken idea. I think those metaphors do a better job conveying to us, because we are embodied beings and we know the world we actually do know reality, even when Descartes opened his eyes again to walk down the stairs, go find some food. We inescapably know the world as embodied creatures. Now, the other thing, I think that the most important thing we need to know about God is the reality of his love and the reality of grace, it seems to me. And we can describe love and grace. We can talk about it. We can define it. we can give seminarians tests to make sure they understand what the doctrines that define those things are about. But finally, it seems to me that that knowledge of love and knowledge of grace is more like an aesthetic perception than it is an analytic perception. I think we experience that even in love between human beings, where there's a dimension of knowledge in hugging, for instance, or as I've tried to suggest in gift giving, that something is conveyed, some reality is conveyed. I wouldn't say a truth is conveyed, but a reality is conveyed. C.S. Lewis wrote wonderfully about how imagination functions, and I'll stop on this point. He says, reason is the organ of truth. But imagination is, how does he put it, the organ of reality. That reality is bigger than what truth can convey. Not all of reality can be conveyed to us adequately through propositions. And so we need images. We need metaphors like shepherd and king and father and all of those things that we actually acquire an understanding that can't be reduced to propositions. And I think that's how all art works. I think, a lot of artists have commented on this. Flannery O'Connor used to say, when people say, well, what does that story mean? The meaning isn't, she says, I can't climb down into it and retrieve the meaning and come back out and pull it out. The story means what the story is. The meaning of the story is contained in the shape of the story. And I think that's, while that may be dissatisfying to a lot of people, we'll pray for them for that. I will stop there because I need to get some rest, and I'll see you all back here tomorrow. Thank you.